This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later this hour, the eye docs are in. Yeah, it's your chance to ask an ophthalmologist. We'll be taking your questions about eyes, eye health. What are those little floaters you sometimes see moving across your visions? What's up with those? We're gonna get into all kinds of eye questions. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to ask an ophthalmologist. I'll repeat that, 844-724-SciTalk or 724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. But first, as you get older, your eyes age too, your vision becomes less crisp, small print gets harder to read, cataracts, a clouding of the lens in your eye is often the culprit. Treatments are effective and usually involve surgically removing the lens. But now researchers are looking at new tools to combat cataracts using human stem cells. And the results were published this week in the journal Nature. Joining me now to talk more, to comment and analyze the work is James Funderburg. He's a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He was not involved in either of these studies, but I'm sure he knows enough about them. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Give us an idea of just what the researchers did there. How did they get the lens to regenerate using stem cells?
Well, this is a kind of a large group from Guangzhou, China. They had the idea that the cells on the outside of the lens, which are called lens epithelial cells, might actually be stem cells. So they did some rather elegant experiments where they showed that they did have the properties of stem cells. They grew them in a dish, and actually, they turned into little lenses that you would focus the light. So they had this hypothesis that maybe in some cases you don't need to put a plastic lens into the eye, that actually those stem cells could help actually regenerate a new lens.
And so they tested this out in animals?
They started off in rabbits. They went in and did a normal cataract operation, except rather than replacing the plastic with a plastic lens, they just left the lens as a little flat disc in the eye. And within a few months, they showed that these lens epithelial cells had grown and turned into new fiber cells and regenerated the lens, wow, a perfectly transparent lens.
They moved to human infants.
The second stage actually was to a monkey model, macaques, because mm-hmm. that pretty much mimics the human eye, and the same thing happened. So they did actually do a clinical trial with human infants.
And it worked.
Cataracts are pretty unusual in infants and children, but when they occur, they're pretty devastating. And the normal intraocular lens doesn't work very well. There's a lot of complications. So they did 12 babies under two, 24 eyes. They removed the material from the lens as if they were doing a normal cataract operation and just left it that way. And within 6 to 8 months, all of these lenses had regenerated. They had good vision and no complications.
Wow. It would seem like this is ready for prime time already.
I think because this doesn't involve any kind of manipulation outside of the body or any kind of new devices, that this could probably be, based on this paper, a surgeon could just go ahead and do this operation. It's a slightly different technique. They approach the lens from the side rather than the front, but other than that, it should be usable almost immediately.
So you wouldn't need any FDA okay on this, or?
Probably not. You might need an institutional review board to make sure that the surgical procedure is okay, but I don't think the FDA would need to be involved.
That's amazing. There was a second stem cell study out in Nature, and this team used stem cells to build differentiated eye tissue.
Right. These used the famous iPS cells, which are called induced pluripotent stem cells. Now, pluripotent means that cell can be anything in your body from nose to your toes. But the problem is it doesn't come with a user's manual, you know. Mm. How to get that particular pancreas or liver cell is the tough part, and it's a lot of work. And this is a large group, and they did excruciating amount of work. But they came up with this method of differentiating the cells. They put the little cells, the little blob, in the middle of the dish, and then just changed the culture medium on them for five or six different types of media over a period of 3 months. And the cells spread out into a pattern that looks remarkably like a fried egg. But when they analyzed these, they realized there were disks, almost like the rings of Saturn, and each ring had a different type of cell in it. And they said, oh, look, here's the middle ones are like retina cells, and then the center ones look like lens cells, and finally on the outside look like corneal epithelial cells. And so they scraped these cells up and did a purification step, and sure enough, they had 99% corneal cells, and they showed that they could work in an animal model. They had an animal model of corneal blindness, and they put these cells on there, and they cleared up the eye and worked perfectly. So very exciting prospect that this may, too, also be almost ready to translate.
Because that's a very, very common operation, isn't it, replacing the cornea?
The whole cornea, yes. But people who have problems with their corneal epithelium can't benefit by the corneal transplant because the stem cells are not part of the tissue that's transplanted. So that's a problem for them, and there's been a lot of effort to get stem cells to fix this problem, and this may be a new solution.
So how do these two studies move the research on ocular stem cell therapy? How far off do you think these are? You say they're ready. They could be used right now.
Well, the IPS, you know, that would be a FDA approval process. This study was done in Japan, and I think in Japan the barriers are a little lower for using stem cells. In the U.S., not a lot of stem cell applications have been approved because the FDA is still very cautious about whether stem cells are going to do what they want them to do.
Yeah, but you're very experienced. You've been researching other tissues that can be used as a source of stem cells to treat eye diseases, right?
Right. We're also interested in the cornea and corneal scarring, so we've been looking at the stroma, and we've taken cells from various parts of the body. We've looked at wisdom teeth. They're very good stem cells in your wisdom teeth. We've looked at adipose tissue. But our favorite for the moment is actually taking a tiny biopsy from the surface of the cornea, and out of it grow some rather nice stem cells. We're involved in some, our collaborators are doing some clinical trials in India right now, and those ocular stem cells are actually clearing up corneal scars. So maybe preventing people who need transplants from needing to get a transplant.
Do you think you might repair blindness sometime with stem cells?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of blindness, you know, because the eye has a lot of different places it can fail. There are actually clinical trials going on for macular degeneration, which is one of the biggest blinding diseases in the U.S., using embryonic stem cells.
Wow.
That's happening in the U.S. right now.
Wow. That's a thing. This is very fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Funderburk, for coming on and talking to us today.
Well, I'm so happy to be on your program.
We're very happy to have you. James Funderburk is a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We're going to continue our vision theme. Speaking of vision, who hasn't heard this warning from mom? Don't read in the dark. You're going to ruin your eyes. Or it's a favorite line among parents, especially when bedtime rolls around. But is there any truth to it? Or maybe you've heard some variation on this headline. Don't give up your eyes for an iPhone, right? Should you be worrying about the effects of all that screen time on your eyeballs? It's the kind of question you might ask your ophthalmologist. And if you weren't so busy answering the question, which looks better, this or this? This, you know, what goes on at the ophthalmologist? Well, you can now ask an ophthalmologist. It's the latest installment in our Ask an Expert series. The eye docs are in. We're going to help bring your eye queries into focus.
Oh, no.
Yeah, first of many puns this hour. Maybe you're a contact wearer. Ever wonder what do you do if you fall asleep in with your contacts on? You know, sometimes they get a little stuck. Or what about when your eyes all start pulsing? What does it do? What's going on there, too? Well, our number, 844-724-8255. That's our number. It's 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at Science Friday. It's at SciFry is our handle there. And we're going to be doing an Ask an Ophthalmologist. Let me introduce them. Lisa Park is a clinical associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at NYU's Langone Medical Center here in New York. She's also the co-host of Dr. Radio's The Ophthalmology Show on Sirius XM. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
You're welcome. Ann Summers is a ophthalmologist at Ridgewood Ophthalmology across the river in Ridgewood, New Jersey. She's also a spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. Welcome. to Science Fry.
Wonderful to be here. I'm very excited.
We were talking a little bit before that when you go to a party or something, you get cornered, right?
Always. People come up and they say things to me like, I have dry eye, I'm using these artificial tears. Here, let me get my purse. I'll show you what I'm using. What do you think? Or I had someone come up to me in church once who said, you know, I can't see out of part of my eye. It started last night and it doesn't hurt at all. You don't think it's a problem, do you? And I absolutely knew from her description, new flashes of light, new floaters. Lisa will check me on this. Mm-hmm. She had a retinal detachment. And I could tell her right there at coffee hour, your retina is off. But she said, but it's painless. So people, everyone's curious about their eyes. Everyone worries that wearing reading glasses will make you more dependent on glasses. No, reading glasses, your eyes are going to get worse no matter what you do.
Lisa, you get cornered with the same
amount of glasses. Absolutely. The number one question that I get asked is because for those who are in the studio, you can see I'm wearing glasses.
Me too.
And so people are always very suspicious. Why is the eye doctor wearing glasses? And, you know, what I tell people, you know, because everyone asks me about laser vision correction and using LASIK or various other means of reshaping the front surface of the eye in order to get rid of glasses. And what I tell people is it's a great procedure for the right candidate. And so the most important thing is to be evaluated fully by an IMD, an ophthalmologist who's experienced in doing advanced testing of the eye to determine whether you're a good candidate. And not everybody is, and it turns out that I'm not. And
so you should respect the doctor who says no.
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, that's an important thing. You really, you know, to operate on somebody who has potentially good vision and to run the risk of losing that best corrected vision is something to think very, you know, carefully about.
All right. We're going to think carefully about taking our calls when we come back because we have melted down the call board. But you can still call. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us if you can't get in by phone. You can get online at SciFry, SCIFRI. Lisa Park and Ann Summers is here to answer your calls. We'll be right back to talk to an ophthalmologist after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about your eyes, everybody's eyes, and it's your chance to ask an ophthalmologist. And if you have a question, give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Our ophthalmologists on call today are Lisa Park, Clinical Associate Professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at NYU's Langone Medical Center in New York. She's also co-host of Dr. Radio's The Ophthalmology Show on Sirius XM. And Ann Summers, ophthalmologist at Ridgewood Ophthalmology in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and a spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. I want to give out the same kind of caveat I do every time we talk to doctors. We cannot really give you any personal medical advice. It's unethical for us, and we're not going to do that, but we can answer questions in general. And the first question I have is I'm going to ask you, Ann, here's something I didn't know, that we actually have a dominant eye, just like we have a dominant hand.
Absolutely. All of us have a dominant eye. Some people can switch back and forth, but it's really, really, really useful because once you hit 40 or over, you start to need reading glasses. And what we can do is we can fit people with contact lenses where they can see well for one eye for distance, one eye for near. Because you have a dominant eye, we set the dominant eye for distance and the non-dominant eye for near. So that I, for instance, I'm over 40, so I can play squash, play tennis, do eye surgery, drive my car to New York, all with one set of contact lenses and no reading glasses. And it's just marvelous. When we do intraocular lens surgery, when we do cataract surgery, we also offer that to people often. As it's called monovision. It sounds bad, but it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I think there's a simple test. Did you put it on your website?
Yes, how to do it?
Oh,
we have
good.
It on our website. It's sciencefriday.com/eyes. But I'm interested in hearing what you, as a tennis player, you have a lens that you use for all your sports?
Absolutely.
Because of the dominant eye?
Yes, absolutely. So I have a great game, by the way.
We'll have to talk about that more later.
We'll play.
844-724-8255. What's the difference? The first question people want to know is what's the difference between an optometrist and an ophthalmologist?
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, you know, they are both categories of eye care providers and can provide, you know, much advice regarding the eyes. The main difference is that an ophthalmologist is an IMD, a medical doctor, so somebody who's attended medical school and studied the medical underpinnings for eye disease. And the second is that ophthalmologists are the ones who can not only prescribe medications and eye drops, but also do all of the eye surgery that is used to treat eye conditions. So that's the main difference. Oftentimes, if you go to some place, like if you go to the mall and you go to an eyeglass store, they'll have an optometrist there who will check your eyes and give you a prescription for glasses. But for any interventions, treatments, surgery, like the LASIK right. we talked about earlier, that's somebody you'll go to an ophthalmologist for.
All right, let's go to the phones, because that's what we're talking about, ask an ophthalmologist. And our first question comes from Cameron Park, California, from Sharon. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. I was wondering, with macular degeneration, when is it appropriate to stop driving?
Oh, well, the state of California will tell you that, because this is Dr. Summers answering the question for that one, because each state will determine what your vision has to be with best possible glasses. So if, for instance, in New Jersey, it's 20/50. If you can't see the 20/50 line, you can't have a license. If you have a very small constricted visual field, if your peripheral vision is very bad, you can't have a driver's license. So it's really a matter of safety. And the DMV, and your own judgment. Do you have macular degeneration?
She's gone.
Oh, gone.
She's gone, yeah. Let's move. Stay in California, but let's go to Berkeley, to Frank in Berkeley. Hi, Frank. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
So my question is, I heard a long time ago that you could exercise your focusing muscles, looking far away in the distance and then looking close up, back and forth to maintain good vision. Is that true, or does that sound ridiculous?
That's an interesting thing. And of course, anytime we exercise part of the body, that's always a good thing. However, when it comes to the eyes, one of the things that Anne alluded to a little earlier is the fact that over the age of 40, the ability to see close gets harder and harder. And that's just a natural thing. People come to my office and they say, Dr. Park, you made me old, when I tell them they need reading glasses. And I say, no, this happens to everybody. And exercising or trying to do things to prevent that from happening, unfortunately, doesn't really work so well. And so it's a natural progression. Again, there are some people who have certain conditions where they can benefit from what we call pencil push-ups, looking at a pencil closer and closer to their eyes. But that's for particular types of conditions. And so the vast majority of people, I'm going to say, use your eyes and don't worry about exercising or not exercising
right.
them.
You know, we keep hearing that as you get older, you get far more farsighted, you need glasses. I discovered that as I got older, my astigmatism got better. What is going on there? I'm reading better, you know?
Well, astigmatism is a separate thing.
Yes.
You've become probably more nearsighted. Your nearsight's gotten better, but your distance vision is not so good. People who are nearsighted will always have good near vision. But when they need to look in the distance, they need the glasses for distance, and that makes their distance vision blurry. So you won't lose that near vision. Astigmatism usually doesn't change. Astigmatism means there's one power in one direction and one power in the other direction in that lens mm-hmm. that's required to see. Unless you have a disease called keratoconus, it's unlikely to have the astigmatism itself change. Mm-hmm. But the lens is a living thing. The lens changes in your eye. And so we encourage people to come back and see us every 2 to 3 years who wear glasses, because the glasses change and the context change and the vision for distance and for near changes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to someone who has a question about this. Brock in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hi, Brock.
Hey, how's it going, Ira?
Hey there.
My question is this. I do have keratoconus in my right eye, and I was wondering if it is possible to have it fixed LASIKly or surgically, or is it just something that I'm going to have to deal with for the... I'm 40, so I don't mind, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm not looking around.
Lisa Park?
Yes, this is a very interesting question. So keratoconus is a condition where there's progressive worsening astigmatism associated with thinning and what we call steepening of the cornea. And so the first thing I will say is that you absolutely would not be a good candidate for laser vision correction. That is something that is really a contraindication simply because when there's progressive thinning, it becomes dangerous to do laser to that reshapes that part of the cornea. That being said, we do know that there are patients who have progressive thinning of the cornea that actually starts to stabilize, especially if you're around age 40. And so if your astigmatism can be corrected with contact lenses, especially the rigid contact lenses are usually the best to give you the best vision in a person with keratoconus. There's something that I should mention also, that there are treatments to stabilize keratoconus, and these are known as collagen cross-linking on the cornea. This is something that's being done widely throughout Europe and is not FDA approved yet in the United States, but it's something that all of us know a lot about, and we're eager to have that come to be an FDA approved treatment, but it's something you may want to investigate. So collagen cross-linking is something that we usually do in keratoconus.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Well, everybody wants to know.
And that's
that.
Not Ira.
I'm only 750. Lost a little weight. And that is what every mother is telling their kids. Don't read in the dark. You're going to ruin your eyes. Well, of course, you can't read in the dark, but in the dim light, you're going to ruin. Is that true or what's?
Absolutely not true. No. Children can see better in the dark than we can. A child of 10 will see better in the dark. And my child, I remember going up to see his room at one point. Ben was trying to do his Spanish homework underneath the covers because I told him to go to bed and he's trying to get it done. So I thought it was amazing he could see. As we get older, our night vision is not as good as it is when you're young. But reading, using your eyes for distance or for reading, wearing your glasses or not wearing your glasses are neither a crutch nor are they therapy. Glasses, unless you have crossed eyes or lazy eye, glasses just help you see better. There's been some studies showing that maybe children who read it with great intensity and don't go outdoors much have a much higher risk of nearsightedness. And there is an epidemic of nearsightedness going on. There was one study that came out that said 5 billion people are going to have nearsightedness in 2050. It's going to be an enormous. And there was another study that in Korea, 95% of the kids who are 18 years old are nearsighted at this point.
Why? We know why?
Well, part of it is we think the kids are on the screens and on their iPhones and inside. And there was a study showing that if the kids go outside for 40 minutes a day and play outside, the progression of nearsightedness is less. But it's an interesting, and this is not just a little bit of nearsightedness, not -2, -3, -4, but this is -10, -12, very, very nearsighted.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and I'll ask a related question. Let's go to Washington with Marty. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I have cataracts, and I'm wondering how the multifocal lenses for cataract replacement are faring. I've been told they're not very good.
Sure. So what the multifocal implant is, when we remove a cataract, we replace it with an artificial lens. And the lenses are made out of a type of material like acrylic. And the vast majority of people get what's called a monovision, a single vision lens. And as we were talking about earlier, if you're able to see at distance with this lens, then you're not able to read without reading glasses. The multifocal is a premium lens, usually not covered by insurance, and it has multiple rings in it. Some are focused at distance and some are focused at near. So this enables to give you a range of vision and get you out of glasses for a large proportion of the things that you do. Not for everything, not for 100%, but it can. What I always tell my patients is that you always got to give up something to get something. So what do you give up? You give up your best possible vision at any particular focal length. And it's just something that if you feel that you want really, you know, perfect vision at a particular, you know, in distance or for reading, just understand you're going to give up a little bit of that to get the freedom to get out of your glasses.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you as a follow-up. Parents may have heard of these Ortho-K contact lenses that are being prescribed for nearsighted kids. Are these any good?
I think that's a very good question. So the Ortho-K, it is something that we're seeing in greater numbers. And what this is putting a device on the surface of the eyes, usually where our children are sleeping, in order to reshape, sometimes flatten the cornea so that they're able to have a particular focal length when they wake up. The number one thing I will tell you is that it's not permanent. So in other words, you're flattening or reshaping, and you know, it's not something that is going to prevent the development of nearsightedness or change the eye permanently in any way. The other thing I will say is, personally, I don't recommend, especially young people, put things and sleep with them on their eyes overnight. When I was a medical student, there was a study that made the front cover of the New England Journal of Medicine showing that if you sleep in contact lenses, you increase your risk for corneal ulceration, which is a scratch and an infection on the cornea, by tenfold. And these kinds of infections can be devastating. And so it's something just that, you know, you're running that risk when you do something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to Sue in Rochester, New York. Hi, Sue. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much. I was wondering if you could discuss closed-angle glaucoma and maybe some of the causes and the treatments for glaucoma, the closed angle.
Sure. Dr. Simers, yeah.
Absolutely. There's two kinds, or there's many, many, many different kinds of glaucoma, but two major forms. 90% of glaucoma is open-angle glaucoma. It has no symptoms. You don't know you have it until you have irreversible peripheral visual loss. Early diagnosis, early treatment with simple drops prevents blindness. That's the open-angle glaucoma. Narrow-angle glaucoma is much less common in the United States. It's more common in Japanese and Chinese people and very far-sighted people. But narrow-angle glaucoma, you have no symptoms until one day you wake up or you are walking down the street and you get pain, nausea, redness, and perhaps irreversible loss of vision. That is a medical emergency. It requires a laser treatment of the iris that takes about 5 minutes, and it will prevent loss of vision, and the pain goes away, and the eye hopefully is not damaged. When we see narrow angle in a patient, we follow this angle carefully, and we will do a preventative laser iridotomy. Again, takes 5 minutes, and it will prevent you from having an angle closure glaucoma attack. So a lot of times patients, when they come in, I look at their eye and I say, your eye has narrow angles and you need to have this laser treatment. And they say, but I have no symptoms. Well, we're not going to wait till you have them.
Mm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Lisa Park and Ann Summers about ophthalmology. Here's a tweet that came in from Nellie Kepler, who says, if you wear glasses, and meaning bifocals, is there any advantage to asking your eye doctor about computer glasses?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as Dr. Summers mentioned earlier, wearing glasses or not wearing glasses, it all becomes a matter of what you want to see and at what distance you want to see it. And so if you're spending a lot of time at the computer and finding difficulty in a bifocal, trying to find that sweet spot where you can see very clearly, then I would say absolutely. It sounds like a great idea to get a pair of dedicated reading glasses. And I usually tell my patients, you just leave them by the computer. When you're on the computer, you put them on. It gives you a mid-range distance of focus, and it can make things very comfortable for you.
And Dr. Summers, one question about floaters.
Yes.
When should we worry about them? They're a normal part of aging, are they not?
Absolutely. Nearsighted people often get floaters in their 20s and 30s. And these are just, when you look up at a blue sky or a whiteboard, you'll see little things floating around. And that's little degenerated cells in the vitreous of our eye. It's like a tennis ball with a little jelly in it. Mm-hmm. And these little specks don't go away. Those are our regular floaters. But if you notice many new floaters, persistent flashing lights, loss of vision over part of your eye, that is the symptom of a retinal tear or retinal detachment. And I think a really important message is, I know people say to me, gee, you know, I call to get in with my eye doctor, and it's a 4 to 6 week wait for an appointment. If you call any ophthalmologist with new floaters, flashing lights, loss of vision, or pain in the eye, they will generally say, come right over, we will fit you in. We always have about, I'd say 20%, Lisa, of our patients every day are emergencies. And eye pain can't wait. So if you call me and you say, I have many new floaters, or I have pain in my eye, or I can't get my contact lens out, we have those slots open for you, because you can't say to someone, oh, you have eye pain. Oh, how's March 17th? No, you say, come right down. We will fix it right now. And we're used to that. That's just part of ophthalmology. Much of what we do is routine with glasses, contacts, glaucoma treatment that's just preventative. But we are emergency doctors all the time.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. It went by very quickly, hasn't it? Lisa Park, clinical associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at NYU's Langone Medical Center in New York. She's also co-host of Dr. Radio's The Ophthalmology Show on Sirius XM. That's once every couple of weeks?
Absolutely. Every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. There you go. Ann Summers, ophthalmologist at Ridgewood Ophthalmology in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and a spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. And you can test to see which of your eyes is dominant. We have instructions up at sciencefriday.com/eyes. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. It's time to stretch our brain muscles a little, because after the break, we're going to take a trip into the quantum world, where not everything is as it seems. Quantum computers. After the break, stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Few things are more frustrating when you're in a hurry to load a web page than waiting and waiting for that little spinning beach ball to go away. You know what I'm talking about. Well, imagine trying to solve a problem that won't take just a few minutes. No, how about a problem that would take the lifetime of the universe to solve? Like, 14 billion years. I think I'd run out of patience by then. But a different type of computer, a quantum computer, could solve that quandary way faster by harnessing the weird physics of the quantum world. And last week, researchers reported in the journal Science that they had built a quantum computer using only 5 atoms. And they say they could scale it up to a much larger, more powerful device. Here to tell us about it is Krista Svori. She's a senior researcher and research manager at Microsoft Research in Redmond, Washington. And just a note, she wasn't involved in this particular research paper, but she knows all about this kind of stuff. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Svori.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's talk about this paper. They built a quantum computer with 5 atoms. How does that work?
Well, so what this research team did is they actually looked at using what we call an ion trap quantum computer. So they take an atom and then they remove essentially electrons to make it charged. And then they hold these atoms, suspend them in a trap. And this experiment they built up in the lab, and as you mentioned, with 5 atoms, they can run a very small quantum algorithm, namely an algorithm we call Shor's algorithm, that actually allows us to factor numbers. That is, to find the 2 prime numbers that you multiply together to get a number. And in their case, they looked at factoring the number 15, which, of course, they find to be 5 times 3.
Well, that didn't need a quantum computer for that, though, did you?
Yes, of course, we can solve that today on pretty much every device we have.
Our phone number, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Now, of course, that was a very simple factor of 15, but was it there just to demonstrate that it could be done?
Well, that's exactly right. This is really a demonstration of being able to perform a sequence, what we call a quantum circuit, a sequence of logic gates on these atoms that store information in a quantum mechanical way. So this is, you know, a start towards building up towards a larger algorithm. And this algorithm factoring can actually do things once scaled up. It can do things like break the RSA cryptosystem. RSA, of course, is a mainstay of e-commerce today. It's the predominant public key encryption system that we use on the internet. Every time you put your credit card on the internet, it actually encodes it into this problem called factoring. So being able to factor large numbers, much larger than 15, would in fact enable us to learn the credit cards being placed, for example, on the internet.
And a quantum computer could potentially do that.
That's exactly right. Peter Shor, who is now a professor at MIT, actually found a quantum algorithm. So he found the mathematical theory and proved that if we have a quantum computer, indeed a quantum computer could solve this problem and break RSA encryption.
So we should assume then this is like a holy grail of computing, is to come up with a working quantum computer.
Yeah, I definitely see it as a holy grail of computing. What's, you know, perhaps more exciting even than being able to solve something like factoring is the potential of a quantum computer for other problems outside of cryptography. Being able to do things that we simply can't compute today that may be able to solve some of the world's largest problems. You know, thinking about being able to more readily produce artificial fertilizer at less, with less resources, less cost, being able to extract waste carbon from the environment. These types of problems are very, very hard to solve and to study on digital computers, even supercomputers. But a quantum computer actually promises to be able to solve some of these problems or help solve some of these problems, like identifying a catalyst that would allow us to more efficiently capture carbon and help solve global warming. You know, that's something we hope to solve on a scalable quantum computer.
Hmm. Now, let's try to talk about why. I know this is a difficult subject to kind of get your head around. Why a quantum computer works differently than the normal digital computer of ones and zeros that we use now?
Right. So our digital computers, when we, you know, dig down underneath the hood, a digital computer works on binary states. So we think of things in terms of zeros and ones. It's like a light switch. When you think about a normal light switch, the light is on or off. You know, you switch it on, you switch it off. That's what's happening in transistors in our digital computers. But a quantum computer actually allows you to be in a continuous state. It allows you to be what we call in a superposition of states, so you can simultaneously, that's at the same time, you can be in the zero state and the one state. That's something we can't do on digital computers. So this superposition is one of the things behind these quantum computers that really helps with the parallelism and the speedups that we can achieve. And of course, there's other things we take advantage of as well, quantum mechanical principles like interference, entanglement, the ability to, you know, entangle two quantum bits of information, send one across the universe. And when I actually perturb the state of my quantum bit that I held on to, it actually, you know, immediately does something to the quantum bit that was sent to the other side of the universe. So we really take advantage of entanglement, this idea of interference, and this idea of superposition that gives us some parallelism.
This is just so hard to fathom how much more powerful a quantum computer. Can you put a number? Is there a number how much more powerful than one is equal to the other?
Yes. So in the case of a digital computer where we have just zeros and ones and you can only be in the state zero or one, in the quantum computer, I can be in both states simultaneously, and this allows us to scale what we call exponentially better in terms of the storage capacity of the device. So if we can only store a zero or a one, if we need to store both of those bits in a classical computer, we actually need to store the zero and the one in separate bits. But quantum mechanically, we store both in the same bit of information, this qubit. So we get a scaling that a problem that requires, say, n bits, we can store 2 to the n states in n qubits instead of requiring a full n states for that amount.
Hmm. Getting into the weeds a little bit, but we like to do that. How much do you need to know to make a quantum computer? I guess what I'm asking is can anybody with a PhD or an advanced computing or physics degree make a quantum computer at this point?
Well, making a quantum computer at this time really requires some specialized experimental setups. And definitely there are labs around the world working on this in various countries, including the United States. And this work that we're speaking about today was done in Innsbruck, Austria, jointly with folks at MIT. So really you need some special experimental setups In particular, you may need to be able to apply high magnetic fields. You may need a dilution refrigerator that operates at the coldest temperatures on Earth, of minus 459 degrees Fahrenheit, for example. Not all of us have those refrigerators in our homes.
No, I'm getting one next week. This week, Bill Gates held an Ask Me Anything session on Reddit, where in response to a question, he said, quote, Microsoft and others are working on quantum computing. It isn't clear when it will work or become mainstream. There is a chance that within 6 to 10 years, cloud computing will offer super computation by using quantum. Quantum, you know, Bill Gates, you work there over at Microsoft.
Yes.
I hope he's listening. Quantum in the cloud. So the cloud would be made of quantum computers. Could you explain that?
Well, I think perhaps one way to think about this is that a quantum computer is not going to be a device that's sitting on your desk or in your pocket. It's really more like a supercomputer, right? You can actually connect with a supercomputer over a network and then solve computations on that supercomputer, but the supercomputer is not sitting in your office. Similarly, a quantum computer will be a resource that you could connect to in the cloud. So potentially it would be sitting in a cloud environment. It's not going to be physically in your office.
Mm-hmm. We have some interesting questions on our phones, 844-724-8255. Let's see if we can get to some of those questions. Let's go to Jacob in Bay City, Michigan. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Ira. How are you doing today?
Hey there. Go ahead.
I work in IT, and I do programming on the side. I'm just wondering, like, how is this going to translate into, like, modern-day architecture? Are we going to need new programming languages for quantum computers?
All right, good question.
That's a wonderful question, and actually something we're working on here at Microsoft. So you'll perhaps be happy to hear that we actually have a software architecture we recently released on GitHub that actually allows you to program quantum circuits, quantum algorithms, and then actually simulate them on your classical, your digital hardware today in advance of having a fully scalable quantum computer. But indeed, your question raises the issues in programming a very exotic hybrid technology. What's really interesting about a quantum computer is it's actually controlled by a digital computer. A potentially very large digital computer will actually control the quantum computer. So when we think about a software architecture and a programming stack for a quantum computer, we really need to think about the fact that we will have mixed instructions, both classical or digital instructions as well as quantum instructions, and we'll really have to build up a different set of compilation techniques than we have for our digital computers. And that's something we're addressing with a software architecture we call Liquid.
Besides breaking codes and things, is there something in nature, a question about nature, you know, the universe, that you know could be answered if you had a quantum computer, but we don't have one yet?
Right. So that I think this is a great area for quantum computers to really have impact. And we believe, actually going back to Feynman, even as early as the late 1950s, Feynman said, you know, using something like a quantum computer will be able to better simulate physical systems and understand our world. In particular, understanding the ground state of a molecule, understanding dynamics of molecules, understanding these properties of molecules. It's very, very hard to understand these on digital computers. So when I mentioned previously about carbon capture, about nitrogen fixation, which is a way to help produce catalysts and understand artificial fertilizer production, when we think about wanting to find a material that actually superconducts at room temperature, which would enable lossless power transmission, these questions are much better answered on a quantum computer than on a digital computer, because in fact, on a digital computer, solving these problems could take longer than the lifetime of our universe, but only a mere, you know, hours or days of computation on a quantum computer.
Now, that certainly puts how strong in perspective how strong a quantum computer is, and it's quite interesting. And it's interesting to hear that Richard Feynman was still talking about that, or how far back people were talking about quantum computers back in the 1950s. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Krista Savory is a senior researcher and research manager at Microsoft Research in Redmond, Washington. Thanks again. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, you know, today is March 11th, or 3.11, just 3 days away from one of our favorite days, 3.14, which you all know as... That's right, Pi Day. We celebrate it every year, and this year is no exception. So we called up the mathematician James Grime of the YouTube channel Numberphile. That's file, spelled with a P-H. Anyway, we called up James because we wanted to know, well, how many digits of pi do we actually need? And he didn't disappoint us.
So as everyone knows from school, pi is used to calculate the circumference of a circle. The formula for the circumference of a circle is pi times the diameter of the circle. Now, if you wanted to calculate something very large, let's say we wanted to calculate the circumference of the known universe, which is going to be a huge thing. Now, the diameter of the observable universe is about 1 trillion trillion kilometers. So it's a massive thing. And we want to know the circumference of that universe. Now we're going to use pi for that. So we take pi, we multiply it by the diameter, and we can get the circumference, no problem. But pi is something that goes on forever. It's an infinite decimal. It will go on forever. So where do we stop? Now, it turns out that we only need to use 38 decimal places to calculate the circumference of the universe to within the diameter of one hydrogen atom. So by 38 decimal places, I mean it will be a 3.14153589793238462643382793528127958321208.
Wait a minute. Go back. Oh, he's gone. I missed a number there in that sequence of 39 digits of pi. That was a mathematician, James Grime, of the YouTube series Numberphile on why we only need 39 digits of pi. And there you have it. Don't forget, it's a pi. Happy Pi Day will be on March 14th. And oh, by the way, of course, every year that's also Einstein's birthday. March 14th, the same day. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you want to learn more about how computers encode information using bits and write your own name in binary code, we've got that for you. You can visit our website at sciencefriday.com/binary. And while you're up there, we're celebrating cheese for 2 weeks now. You go to we have a nacho cheese recipe at sciencefriday.com/nacho cheese. We have all kinds of cheesy things up there on our website with recipes and how to appreciate cheese. So while you're up there, you can visit that also. And while you're enjoying our cheese, you can also look at all our educational materials up there at the same time. Have a great weekend. We'll all try to do that. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.